May the sacred presence of him who said he would abide in his teaching be our guide. May we follow his glorious example and tread with unfaltering step this noble path until we too shall attain enlightenment. Before we get going, I just want to make one announcement that we have a half-day Zazenkai coming up on this Saturday, April Fool's Day. And for those of you who don't know what that is, it's a great way to dip your toe into the idea of Sesshin. It's basically a four-hour Sesshin. And about 2.5 hours of that 4 hours is untimed Zazen. So basically you follow the dictates of your body and mind, what you're going to be doing during that 2.5 hours. You can go outside and meditate. You can do reclining. You can just stand and do standing meditation, get up and do kin-in and so on. So it's a way for you to monitor your level of effort and find a sustainable way to do it. So again, that's this Saturday afternoon from 1:30 to 5:30, I believe it is. And I think sign up ends tomorrow, does that sound right? Okay. Okay, I'd like to start by reminding ourselves of the Bodhisattva vows. So we'll chant them together just once. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. So I believe in the wisdom of the Sangha, group wisdom. And I see that wisdom here often, here at Dharma Rain, here in our class discussions, in our prison program, in our Oregon State Penitentiary Zen cohort, and even in the broader non-Zen world. We're all going through something and we all have something to offer. And we all have work to do. So sharing all this with each other can be pretty good for Bodhisattva vow practice. And that's why in these classes, I lean heavily on these small group discussions, basically what you can discover among yourselves. I believe I said this last week, maybe every week, that there is no one and only right way to understand the Bodhisattva vows. We all find our own way into them, and we all have our own experiences around them. So though I'm happy to share my understanding in these classes of the vows, I also want to be very careful not to constrain your experience of them around my experience. Make sense? Okay. Yeah, so I think we're going to start. Actually, I think we won't start with your sharing your experience from the homework of last week. Instead, we're going to have some very long small group sessions, and I'll be handing out the questions to help guide those sessions. And I think some of that will draw out any of you who actually worked with us over the past week. I think you'll have the opportunity to share what you've experienced, what you've learned in those sessions, and then a little bit in the larger group afterwards. But I will ask, does anybody have any comments or questions that have come up either from the last class or from what you've been working on? Okay, we'll move ahead. The first Bodhisattva vow, beings are numberless, I vow to free them, is, I think, the most challenging of all the vows. It's the one that people have the most difficulty with. And it also frames the other three. The last three, in a way, can be seen as being the methodology where we come around to practicing the first vow. Most of tonight's class will be on the first vow, and we may not get to the second vow tonight. That's okay with me. I hope it's okay with you. Last week, I suggested considering these vows to be koans, and I think that's especially true of this first vow. Speaking for myself, I definitely struggle with it as a koan. In Jiyu Tenet's translation of Fukan's Zengi, she wrote, "The koan appears naturally in daily life," which is a pretty good description of koan practice in Soto Zen and of the koan nature of the Bodhisattva vows. It's what appears naturally in daily life. Before we get down to the small group discussion, I want to tell you how Huineng, the sixth Chinese Zen patriarch, expressed the Bodhisattva vows in the Platform Sutra. His version sounds very different from most of the versions in use today, and very different from what we just chanted. Huineng lived from 638 to 713 of the Common Era, of this era, putting him in about the same period as Shantideva. And if you remember last week, I also mentioned another sutra that I stumbled over that dealt with Kshitagarbha, a great vow, Kshitagarbha's practice with the vows. All of that in the same time frame. And this is what Huineng wrote. "Learned audience, having repented of our sins, we will take the following four all-embracing vows. We vow to deliver an infinite number of sentient beings of our own mind. We vow to get rid of the innumerable defilements in our own mind. We vow to learn the countless systems and dharma of our essence of mind. We vow to attain the supreme Buddhahood of our essence of mind." So this, does that sound pretty different to you from what we're doing? Yeah, it should. This reads more as the vows of an arhat, somebody who is striving towards their own enlightenment, or the self-development path of Buddhahood, more towards that than to the traditional understanding that a bodhisattva is someone who frees all beings before freeing themselves. Huineng seems to be advising us to clean up our own minds before practicing with our innate aspiration to help others. So keep this approach in mind when considering the questions for your small groups. It's another way to look at it, and it may be the way that some of you need to step into this. Speaking for myself, I will alternate between using Huineng's version, beings are numberless, or beings in my own mind are numberless, I vow to free them. And that's when I'm feeling trapped in my own mind, that's where I need to start.
I was just asking, if you would mind reading the Huineng version one more time?
Sure. "We vow to deliver an infinite number of sentient beings of our mind. We vow to get rid of the innumerable defilements in our own mind. We vow to learn the countless systems and dharma of our essence of mind. We vow to attain the supreme Buddhahood of our essence of mind." For anybody who would like to look into that further, there's a number of different translations, but I think this is one of the more common ones. The Platform Sutra, it's the chapter 6 on repentance. There's some interesting reading in there, and he goes into a lot of detail about what that actually means and how you do it. And then one other thing I want to do before we get into the small group discussion is talk a little bit about playing with the wording of the vows. I think I mentioned last week that I sent out a survey to the Lay Zen Teachers Association, asking them, among other things, does your Sangha practice with the vows regularly? Do you get any pushback from new people? And also, do you use, or what version do you use? And do you encourage people to find their own version? And there was a lot of mix. Most people use something pretty close to the version we use. There are a number of variations. Probably the most common variations is people using the pronoun we instead of I. Beings are numberless, we vow to free them or save them. But here are a couple others. Karen from the Bozeman Dharma Center offered this, that beings are numberless, I vow to awaken with them. So again, a more self-practice tone of this, somewhat reminiscent perhaps of Huineng. The other three vows that they use are very similar to ours. And then Bob from Sacramento Zen Center, this was the most far out one of of the alternate versions. He said, first, I find having a community version, which is similar to ours, for us all to use, along with our personal versions, works very well. My personal version of the four vows keeps evolving. My current version is, beings are not numbers. My vow is touching all and each. Delusions are myself, but bent. My vow is unfolding. Dharma gates are just this point. My vow is turning. Buddha's way is ungraspable. My vow is flowing still. And I would say myself, I kind of feel myself into the vows. And sometimes I'll say it one way and realize, that's not quite where I'm at. And go back and say it a different way. For me, I find the I in the vows very problematic. And we'll talk, well, actually, that's in the questions for you to discuss. That, you know, basically starting from a sense of self feels problematic to me. So very often I will change it to the participle. Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. To make it easy, you could experiment with all the different nouns, verbs, adjectives, and pronouns in the vows. They're all open to change. But another view on altering the vows. In Kyogen's Dharma talk last Sunday, the one that was on tape, obviously, he was talking about why we follow forms and do the same chants together and so forth. What he said was, we do the same things the same way. This builds a karmic affinity among us. And I think that can apply to the vows too, that saying the way that we all say it together can create, even if you're alone, can create that sense of community. And actually, Kenkan, I would invite you.
I think Kevin pretty much nailed it, that, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with finding, you know, tuning in words that work for you, but it's like a long time ago, I think I decided just to accept that the words as written in our chant book are close enough for me, and they're fresh if I'm paying attention every time, and they change every time. So there is kind of spaciousness in bowing to the teaching sort of as it comes, without putting myself into like, I'm going to fix it there.
Yeah.
Change it. And at the same time, there can be value in how would I change it if I wanted to. But, that's really all I think I have to say about it.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. So anyway, those are two slightly different views. And yeah, figure it out yourself. Any questions on that? And the reason I wanted to say a little bit about that is because in the questions, I put in that question, how would you state this vow to more closely reflect how you relate to it? Any questions on that? Yes.
Just a question, kind of relating back to what we were talking about last week about the Dharma range practice and not reciting the vows. And as I was working with them this week, it struck me as kind of odd because they seem fairly fundamental. So it's a little confused as to why they're not part of it.
Well, again, the reasons, the main reason that I've heard is that that these are very serious vows, they're big vows, and especially when you're fairly new to the practice, very hard to understand. And that, you know, and this is true of Roshi Kennett, Kyogen, Gyokugo, all felt that people should not be forced or not feel forced to say the vows or to take the vows. Possibly. Hmm. Now, I did, you know, again, I did ask the other Lay Zen Teacher Association teachers whether they've, you know, had run into that, whether, you know, since they do it regularly and newcomers come in and say them, has anybody pushed back? And I think they all said no. You know, people just, you know, are intrigued by it. They wonder about it, et cetera. I've introduced it to our prison group at the state penitentiary, and I asked them the same question, you know, does anybody feel on the spot with these or forced to take them, or do you have any problem with the fact that we're doing this? And everybody was fine with it. You know, they were intrigued by it. It spoke to them on some level. So yeah, does that?
Yeah, everybody has their own perspective.
Now, I would say, you know, my feeling is that there is a fair amount of openness among the teachers at Dharma Rain to make them more available. You know, it's probably not going to find its way into services quickly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my sense is that probably half the people at Dharma Rain are doing some practice with the vows as it is. I'm sorry?
I think the ordination.
Yeah. Ordination. Yeah. There are a few times. Yeah, the ordination. I think New Year's Eve, I believe we do them. And then Dao Ren practices with them. So it's not, you know, it's not entirely absent. What's that?
So there is a liturgy book at the end of the
room. Yeah. Yeah. I think, in a sense, a vow is like a packet of energy. You know, you're sending out this wish, and our bodies can't tell the difference between, like, if we're watching TV and we see something violent happen, our bodies react as though it's real. You know.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Distinguish between, oh, I'm just saying this, you know, just to say it, versus like, I'm really making this vow. And so I really support the idea of having a class and this kind of conversation about it. I think it's appropriate that it be taught and people made aware of it. And I'm, you know, in that camp of using it judiciously,
mm-hmm.
you know, publicly, for that reason, because I think in effect we're really making that vow when you say it at some level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a school of thought in raising children. I know because I'm right in the middle of that school. And there's many schools. They contradict each other. One of them is that people are always talking about is, do you make children say please and thank you by rote or not? Do you make them say, I'm sorry? Say, I'm sorry, right? Sorry, right? When they don't really mean it. And so this is what's in my mind when I think of vows. If somebody new comes in and, you know, age 42, here's the vows, here's the vows, is that as valuable as sort of holding them separate and saying, you come to these, work with these, not holding them up on the shelf, don't touch these, but take them down when you're really, when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that similar thinking.
I think that is essentially what we're doing here. Mm-hmm. You know, that I'm certainly not trying to get everybody here working with the Bodhisattva vows all the time. My objective is just to put them out there, talk about them, explore them, and then you can make your own choice whether this is something that would be useful to your practice at this point or somewhere down the line. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to do small group discussion now. And I've done up the questions. We have the first vow on one side and the second vow on the other side. And these are just questions that I'm thinking you might find it useful to explore. I'm also going to pass out, or actually Zonio is going to pass out. Once we split up into the groups. Okay, let me keep one of those. And I think there's enough that you can give each group a couple of these, but not each person, okay? So anyway, these questions, and I try to put them in an order that makes some sense into diving down into the vow. So look at them, use them as a start for your conversation. If you're not finding a particular question useful, chime in with another question, or ask your own questions. And let's see, I'd ask you to reach deep when you're considering these questions. I don't mean this to be a philosophical seminar. We want to get down to our experience, our deepest aspirations. Share the bandwidth, listen deeply to each other, and I'll ring the bell once every 5 minutes. I think we'll take about 20 minutes for this, and see where we are at the end. And when it's time to end, I'll ring it twice. Okay?
And what do we use the paper for?
Paper is, you know, there's a bunch of questions there. You got a lot of time to talk, so you might want to keep notes for sharing with a larger group. Okay? Plus, I would love, you know, I don't think we're going to have time to share everything. So I would love to see what you come up with after the fact. Okay. And yeah. Split into, I think groups of three seemed to work in the last class, so why don't we go for groups of three? Yeah. Also try to keep your voices low enough so all the groups can hear themselves. Who would like to share something from what your group came up with? Yes. All right.
I can.
Whoa.
Thank you.
So I'm Ken Gunn, and I can say something about like my reaction to one of the questions and then open some space for other folks. But I wanted to reflect on the how it struck me what you said about Wei Nang's adding sort of like in my mind to all that. And to me, that was a reminder that any all beings out there are like first and foremost perceived by my mind. And so it was a connection. This, you know, it established a connection between me and all beings. So it wasn't a separator.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't either or. It was like that.
Okay, thank you.
Would you like to say anything?
No.
Shy people.
Okay, saving all beings by silence. Who else?
We got one over here.
I'm Jen. One of my group mates talked about beings are numberless. I vow to free them all. Like that being sort of just inspiration to carry yourself. My word was humble, like more in like kind of like a feeling of service to others as you move through the world and to sort of help to kind of let go of ego or selfishness. So just sort of like a way of kind of holding it in the world.
Okay. When I was wandering around, I was hearing a number of groups kind of struggling with that question of ego, you know, mm-hmm. coming from that place of ego. Yeah, and I think that definitely comes up as part of this koan. Anybody else would like to share things from their group?
We discussed the issue of the ego as well, kind of in regards to the prompt letter I. But I guess I did just want to reflect that I feel like that's kind of what you're doing here, is just not being didactic, I think is the right word, with what these mean. So it's kind of like, okay, let me think about the vow again. Beings are numberless, I vow to free them. Instead of like asserting an idea or being a certain way, it's kind of like enabling others to be curious. And I think that maybe tends to take care of like the ego issue. And then we discussed the word intention as well, which I think can be helpful.
I'm not going to, this was my idea, not theirs, so, but maybe they agree. One of the changes that I just wrote down here was interesting to play with is around the ego and I and them. Just change it to we vow to free us. And I was sort of playing with that. It's like, well, that got rid of the individual and this separate self, and it's just one big thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One thing that I shared with my group was trying to experiment with that idea of trying to subvert the ego in this vow And a means of doing that, I thought, was trying to aspire to be the purest conduit possible to transmit Dharma to others, without allowing the obstruction of self or the impurities, delusions that the self bring about through transporting that Dharma to other beings. So that was that's been my way in the beginning of thinking about this vow, of trying to tackle that.
And how do you go about doing that?
By internalizing Dharma through working with precepts, for example, through correct conduct, and immersion, I suppose.
I'm sorry?
Immersion.
Okay.
In Dharma.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else?
One of the ways I've worked with this vow to free all beings has been actually to pull something from, I think it's the 10th grave precept, and it's part of my morning ritual, and it's just let us rescue ourselves together with all beings, and that just resonates for me in a way that the I and the them of this vow sort of feels like it gets in the way of, for me.
Okay. I think we'll do, we'll do J, and then let's dive into the second Bodhisattva vow after that.
I was just going to share in our group that a lot of it was a lot of questions, and in particular around two things. One was, what's the nature of freeing? Like, what does that mean? You know, if the world goes on and you have to die and there's pain and there's pleasure and there's this sort of, then what is freeing? And how do you free somebody else? And what's the relationship between freeing yourself and freeing everybody? And we just, it was just like into a big rabbit hole. I think another thing related to that, it was stuff about the dualism between self and other. And then the relationship between those two things. So when you're vowing to do this, are you vowing to, like, I could have saved myself, but now I'm going to hang around, like, sequentially until a whole bunch of people, everybody gets freed? Or is it the sort of, is like a countdown sort of thing? Or is it the sort of thing where the act of freeing yourself is the act of freeing everybody? And so almost kind of like a slow versus fast.
The traditional explanation is, the second thing you said, that, or maybe the first thing you said, that you're going to hang around until everybody is free.
And
that's problematic.
The Chinese version, where the mind version is almost a little bit more like that second version. In the act of myself, freeing myself, I, in that act, free everyone.
Yeah. And again, this gets back to the wording also, that free kind of locks us into a certain direction here. So other verbs meet. I made a mistake, or actually once I was saying vowing to free them, and I guess I wasn't maybe my lips were sticking together or something like that. And what I heard myself say was bowing to freedom. and a light went on. It was like, okay, well, that actually kind of makes sense. Bowing to freedom. Sometimes I say bowing to meet them. And again, it's, you know, feeling my way into what is actually my path here. Okay, let's do a very short session. You know, it's going to be just over about 5 minutes or so. Turn the sheet over and look at the second Bodhisattva vow and see what you come up with. Did you find it helpful to have those questions? Did they help your exploration?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. We have like 4 minutes left. I could share what you did, or if you would like, I could share something I wrote with something I was struggling with around the first vow. I'll do that. Okay. So anyway, I wrote this about a week ago. And this is excerpts from basically my daily practice diary, which I remember to write in maybe once or twice a year. So I noticed last week that I was feeling overwhelmed with my sadness over so many beings close and far whom I perceived to be in suffering. And so some overwhelmedness around feeling my vow to free them, or at least comfort them in their suffering and mourning for them when I offer merit and beyond. What came up for me then was a realization that I perceive the dukkha of others very differently from how I experience my own dukkha and difficult challenges. I'm much more affected by their perceived suffering than by my own. For the most part, I don't experience my own difficulties as tragic, needing to be quickly resolved or gotten rid of, not even as particularly negative. They just are. They may be unpleasant, but so what? And this is my attitude, not my conceptual thought about this. Also, for the most part, I experience all this as an opportunity to learn, to gain new perspective on my delusions, to enter new Dharma gates. This was the case when my appendix ruptured about a year ago and I was hospitalized and in significant pain for most of a week. This was the case when I felt overwhelmed by the suffering of many close to me and everyone everywhere. And this is the case when I feel blah or depressed, uncertain, fearful. They just are. I want to evolve through these experiences to a place of greater wisdom and practice, and I'm not inclined to shut down the painful experience on the way. I think there's a serious flaw or delusion in my objectifying the suffering of others. William Faulkner said something along the lines of tragedy is secondhand. And then there was a quote that I found that was attributed to him, finding that there was nothing to save, who had hoped to save her, came to save what did not need the saving, and lost instead himself. Wow, right on. I believe this pretty accurately describes my mistake, trying to save what doesn't need saving, trying to eradicate there, and there is family, friends, everyone, their painful opportunities for growth. I cherish my own painful opportunities for growth and yet protect others from their painful opportunities for growth. And in this well-intentioned concern and interference, I burn out, I lose myself. My fundamental Buddha nature. How screwed up is that? How might I practice with this more helpfully for others and for myself? Well, the Zen teacher version of this is the reminder that the student must do 95% of the work, the teacher 5%. Allow others to do their work. Don't steal that from them. And I think that's a great reminder for aspiring bodhisattvas. I'll also try to call to mind our human characteristic of anatta, not self. Another way to see my unwise response to the difficulties of others is that I separate myself from them. I create a self and I create an other. And this is fundamental wrong understanding. If their difficulty is like my difficulty, then there's no need to rescue them. We all experience dukkha, and we can all grow from knowing our dukkha. And I think I'll stop there. I wrote a little bit more about some ways of doing that, but we are out of time. So,
yay you! That was super helpful. I love that.
Okay. Okay, so we'll do Vespers now. And thank you all for this. I wish there were more time to share everything in every direction. But thank you for your work with this.